Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Colin Bennett. He started out life as a professional musician. Since when he's written several plays, became an electronic engineer, started his own business in London and founded a consulting agency. And I believe since then he's still been involved in the writing business. And his new book is a biography of Edward J. Ruppel, which we are going to discuss, which is regarding the UFO era of the 1950s, when Edward J. Ruppel was asked to lead the investigating team who were writing Blue Book. Now, that occurred in the 1950s. And what Colin has done is rewritten the book, Flying Saucers Over the White House, as a biography. Welcome to the program, Colin.
Good evening. Yes, and thank you for your invitation.
Well, you're very welcome. I suppose the first question must be, why would you want to reissue a book, from the 1950s. What attracted you to that idea?
Well, it's about an episode in Washington history, post-war, which has almost disappeared. A fantastic episode, which no academic historian appears to have noticed or dealt with. And it, as such, the invasion of the Washington sky by what appear to be UFOs were slipping out of history. And I thought, well, we'll have a look at Ruppel's report on this business and see if it can make a contribution to the study of UFOs within the body of ufology in general. Ruppel himself was an Air Force captain, and he was in charge of Operation Blue Book in 52. Project Blue Book in 1952 was the official United States Air Force investigation into the UFO phenomenon. And Ruppel was head of this investigation.
Right. So was he put in to lead that investigation because he was, shall we say, set up to debunk the UFO question?
Well, I don't know whether he was set up. I mean, it wouldn't be necessary to set him up. It was, if you wanted to get rid of Ruppel, and there were quite a few attempts to get rid of him, you just cancelled the project. Nobody would scream. Nobody would have objected. You know, it would have been very difficult for Ruppel to defend himself. No. Blue Book was set up by Lieutenant Colonel Rosengarten of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Dayton, Nevada, Dayton, Ohio, I think, yeah. And they were disturbed by 52, of course. There were disturbing reports of UFOs, and you couldn't get rid of the reports because every policeman, every housewife, every kid on his little bicycle, saw them of one sort or another, as they are today. There are still many, many unaccountable reports of UFOs, but the Air Force got rid of the UFO a long time ago, in 69. They don't want to know about the UFOs. Now. Hello?
Yes, right. I thought you were going to say something extra then.
All right.
So during that period of time, which was quite a long time, did they appraise the situation and make conclusions at various stages? Or was it a case of leaving it until they were perhaps even inundated with sightings and then made some sort of analysis? I mean, how did they decide how to make their conclusions?
Well, these were fairly liberal days as far as the UFO was concerned. The Air Force was quite liberal in those days, and Ruppelt served under Lieutenant Colonel Rosengarten, who again was a bit of a liberal, and he constituted a small-scale investigation called Operation Blue Book, and the Air Force tolerated this for a time, for about 3 or 4 years, before cynicism set in, and rather sinister put-downs began, and the Air Force began to get rid of the UFO good and proper. They didn't like it. And this is given to people to write books about conspiracy theories, about how the Air Force got rid of Ruppelt and it got rid of Operation Blue Book. Nobody's proved anything about this, but all the time Ruppelt was running Operation Blue Book, he came against incredible opposition from Air Force circles. And his operation was restricted to probably 7 or 8 individuals. And he was not given money for intensive investigation or putting the project on a widely led scientific basis. In other words, he was kept hobbled.
Right. Now, when you said he met a lot of opposition, was that because people were scared to acknowledge that UFOs existed because it may affect their career, or was there a more, as you might say, sinister reason behind it?
Well, here we're into matters of opinion. Let's take the two ends of a spectrum of belief, if you like. One end says the aliens are here, and that's the exopolitical end of ufology. They say that alien beings in humanoid form are controlling Earth and managing its institutions. All I can say to that opinion is that if aliens are managing the institutions of Earth, they're not making a very bloody good job of it. That's the extreme, shall we say, right-wing point of view.
Yes, yes.
The other point of view is the extreme puritanical scientific point of view. I suppose the man who leads that point of view is Stanton Friedman, who's written books about the Roswell episode and has connected it with all kinds of conspiracies within the military. So they are, it's a book pile. You've got the right-hand view, they're here, and you've got the left-hand view, such as Stanton Friedman, writing very, very sensible and scientific informed books, none of which I personally agree with, but I am being objective here.
Right.
And speaking of Stanton Friedman as a writer on to the left of the spectrum. So you've got a pretty good rate, modern, we're talking about modern times now, of course.
Yes. You
know, 50 years late, 60 years after Ruppelt.
So when, or maybe just before Blue Book was finished up, what firm conclusions did Edward Ruppelt make, if any?
Well, here you've got a genuine modern mystery. Ruppelt, of course, was an enlisted man, and therefore his time in the Air Force as a captain was limited. He was enlisted again because of the outbreak of the war in Korea, and he was taken to, as a captain, his former rank, was taken to Wright-Patterson, ATIC, Air Technical Intelligence, to investigate, first of all, the MiG-15, which had been brought to Wright-Patterson from a crashed MiG-15 in Korea. And Ruppelt, being a very, very bright engineer, made an examination with others of the MiG-15, which was giving, at the time, the American jet fighters a serious problem in Korea. The Sabre F-86 could hardly cope with the Russian MiG-15. I suppose it's a lesson in never underestimate the Russians. Western intelligence didn't think the Russians could produce an aircraft as sophisticated as the MiG-15. But the Russians did, and it challenged the Sabre F-86. And so the Americans were very, very interested in the MiG-15. A crashed example was brought to Wright-Patterson, And Rupert was put in charge of examining the aircraft from technical radio guns and everything else. Its guns were fantastic. It had cannon. I think it was 37mm cannon and Sabre. Had old-fashioned World War II 50-cal machine guns. And they were very worried about this. Well, Ruppelt carried out his work, his report on the MiG-15, so well, and so brilliantly, that Lieutenant Colonel Rosengarten decided to appoint him to Project Blue Book. And so Ruppelt inherited the UFO desk on account of his great work and great brain in analysing the MiG-15. And he was a young man, of course. He was in his early 30s at this time, I think very early 30s, and he was judged to be the kind of person to appreciate the reports that were coming in of UFOs. There had been some very, very weak and infertile attempts to analyse UFOs by people who just laughed at the subject and who didn't do any serious work, any serious research. Now, when Ruppelt was given command, he started to put the UFO Blue Book project on a proper scientific basis. This is the first time this had been done. He used statistical methods. He had a team of 8 to 10 people who went out and interviewed people, and as far as 8 or 10 people could, because the phenomenon was very widespread. And carried out punch card commissions to the Battelle Institute. And the Battelle Institute handled the UFO business in terms of who sees these things, what kind of weather. Yeah, this had not been done before. And the conclusion was that most people across the population of America saw these things. There was a general consensus across the population, and housewives, policemen, and everybody else, practically farmers and taxi drivers, they all saw UFOs and reported them at one time or another. And so this may sound common knowledge today, but it wasn't in 1952. Ruppelt hence indicated that these sightings of these strange vehicles in the atmosphere was not confined to drunks or nutcases. Am I loud and clear?
Right. Now, since the main object of the book that Ruppelt wrote was about the Washington incident, can you tell us all about that one?
Yeah. Do you want me to say something about, just for a few minutes, about Ruppelt's war record?
Oh, by all means, yeah. Anything that gives us a picture of the man involved.
It'll give you a little better idea of the man himself.
Yes, by all means. Yes.
Yeah. Is it, by the way, question, is this program pre-recorded?
No, it's going out live.
It's going out live, okay.
It is recorded, but it's live at the moment.
All right, okay. Right, Ruppelt served as an Air Force captain, a very young Air Force captain, on the island of Tinian in the Pacific. Now, the island of Tinian was used during the war against the Japanese, was used as an assembly point for the B-29 bombers, which were preparing to make way for the land invasion of Japan. This is before anyone knew anything about nuclear weapons. America was supposed to make a land invasion, supported by the B-29 bomber support, and of course everyone knew this would lead to terrible casualties. Now Ruppelt was a navigator bombardier, and he was the lead bombardier on Tinian for the B-29. If he could have seen, for instance, Enola Gay, the B-29 which dropped the first nuclear weapon on Hiroshima, he could have seen it take off, and if there had been an accident, if the navigator aboard Enola Gay had been injured in any way or had even had influenza, it might well have been Rupert would have taken his seat and heading for Hiroshima. We all know what happened there, and Rupert himself was an observer of Enola Gay and the triumphant. I'm not a warmonger when I say triumphant. I just say triumphant return from Hiroshima. And Rupert and everyone on the island of Tinea knew that they had a new weapon, terrible, terrifying weapon on their hands. A few days later, Boxcar, another V-29, took off with, I think, the second little weapon, which was called Fat Man. I think the first one was called Thin Man, for Nagasaki. And so events on Tinean Island branded Rupert with history. He was always very, very close to historic events. I mean, he'd been within an hour of taking the navigator's seat in Enola Gay with the first atomic weapon. You don't forget it. You're branded with history. You're branded with the occasion. Mm-hmm. And he felt very proud of that. Negativity about nuclear weapons at that time had not yet set in. The cynicism made the nuclear hit seem like a rather big conventional hit at the time. It was thought by many people for some years that the nuclear hit was in fact a conventional bomb hit of very large proportions.
Right.
Okay, so the war ended, and Rupert left the Air Force and entered the aircraft industry as a senior technician. He spent some years there, for which he was well qualified. Lo and behold, the Korean War broke out, and enlisted men like Rupert, who was still young enough, were taken in largely into the intelligence services. Rupert, as I said, was taken into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as an intelligence officer, and there we link up with the MiG-15.
Mm.
And that, Lieutenant Colonel Rosengarten saw his work with the MiG-15, as I said, to be so good that he gave Rupert charge of Operation Blue Book, which was the very first effective investigation of a UFO phenomenon.
Right. So can you now come to the Washington incident and tell us why that was so important or special?
Yep. Well, Rupert was in charge in July. Let's go to July 1952.
Right.
Rupert's in charge of Operation Blue Book, and he's traveled to Washington on a couple of missions for the Pentagon, mainly discussing weather conditions and writing a few reports. And he was in Pentagon accommodation on the night of July the 19th, 1952. As evening fell on July the 19th, 1952, just let me say something about the three air bases around Washington.
Yes.
Washington, at that time, had the Washington National Airport, the Bolling Air Force Base, and Andrews Air Force Base. The Andrews Air Force Base contained squadrons of F-94 night fighters, which were the night fighter defense of the Washington Capitol. Harry Barnes was the controller at Washington National Airport. And Bolling, during the evening, Bolling Air Force Base reported the approach on its radar. We must remember that there are three powerful radars here,
right,
surveying the night sky, involving not all that much traffic, but certainly with crews, control towers, and a proper filter arrangement. The three radars were Bolling, Andrews Air Force Base, and Washington National Airport. So three fairly good radars and fairly good communication systems were monitoring the situation in the night sky, as of routine. There were reports from radar operators that something like seven glowing objects were seen heading towards Washington. Bolling saw them, Andrews Air Force Base saw them, and Harry Barnes in the control tower, in control room rather, of the Washington National Airport saw them. Harry Barnes, a senior controller, thought the situation was so serious, bearing the Pearl Harbor example in mind, that he got in touch with Andrews Air Force Base and asked them for interceptors immediately. F-94s in the air intercept these shapes, which were maneuvering, and see what they were all about. Armed fighters immediately scramble. And believe it or not, Andrews Air Force Base replied that they didn't have any F-94s at that time because the airfield was being repaired. Do you believe that?
An astonished
Barnes could not believe this, that Washington was without air defense. There were no F-94s at Bolling either. So there wasn't a single jet fighter to use to investigate these glowing orbs, which Bolling reported as one or two of them being showing flight characteristics of above Mach 1, which is, you know, beyond the sand barrier, and performing maneuvers in Mach 1. Now, no aircraft at that time in the U.S. inventory was supersonic. Right. We're used to supersonic, you know, the F-94, poor thing, was a great aircraft of the day, but it was nothing like an F-16. It was subsonic and a decent fighter, but limited to about 680 miles an hour, well below Mach 1. Anyway, Harry Barnes decides to take a panic measure. He gets in touch with Delaware Air Force Base and says, "Scramble, we've got interceptors over and above Washington." Delaware, hours later, can you believe this? It smacks of 9/11. Snaffle. Hours later, a single F-94 arrives and says, and believe it or not, the glowing orbs switched off their light like switching off a room light. The F-94 pilot said he could see nothing and returned to Delaware Air Force Base, low on fuel. Why he was low on fuel, I don't know, because I've taken calculations of the distance that he shouldn't have been out of fuel. But anyway, that's the record. He was out of fuel. So, the Washington night sky was undefended. It sounds like 9/11 again. And here is, I don't know what in the United States Constitution allows an unqualified civilian controller of an airport to control armed night fighters in the sky. Where was the Air Force? Nowhere. A civilian had to take control of an interception. I find that astonishing. It would not happen in the RAF with their Battle of Britain experience. And I don't know the chain of command, but there was no overall good tactical chain of command. No major general, no bright spark was in command saying, "You must do this, you must do that." It was poor Harry Barnes in the Washington National Airport radar control room, unqualified, mind you, unqualified to vector in night fighters trying to do his best. Of course, one must bear in mind that these were quite visible glows in the sky. People were taking photographs of them. It was a Saturday night in Washington, and boyfriends and girlfriends were in the parks taking photographs. Policemen were there. Crowds were pouring out of pubs, theaters, and the cinemas, and looking up at the night sky. It wasn't exactly an obscure event, to say the least. You know, cats and dogs in the parks could have seen them. And lots of people took photographs, and the photographs are all on the web. You can see them. Orbs above the Capitol building, and the Air Force wasn't doing a damn thing about them. No phones from ringing. No intelligence networks. Nothing. but poor Harry Barnes, civilian controller at the Washington National Airport. Of course, right, the press is...
Yeah. I understand from the time that those sightings commenced at 8 p.m., there were some 50 targets right up to 12 p.m.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was a pretty public exhibition. There was nothing obscure about it at all. And the press has, of course, started rolling. And the next morning, there were two-inch headlines in all the Washington, you know, UFOs. You know, with photographs. I mean, you can't get much more public than that. You know, the early morning press are running with two-inch headlines and photographs of the orbs above the Capitol building on the front page. It was such an effect that only one person appeared to be bothered about it. Excuse me, I'm just putting my arm down from this handset. I'm speaking to you from a very primitive handset, and my arm is now back in order. Sorry about that, folks. And the President, President Truman, asked his air attaché, Brigadier General Landry, to contact Ruppelt. I always think that this was an indicator of why Truman was president. He went to the organ grinder and not the monkey. He went to Ruppelt. I mean, imagine, the President of America, the kind of technical staff he could have asked. The Air Force Intelligence Command Network, he could have asked them, but no. He knew he wouldn't get any answer from them, which is a very, very strange situation. The whole intelligence network was either didn't want to know, or were pig ignorant, or wouldn't say anything, or were too scared to say anything, and thus the entire intelligence network of the United States Air Force didn't exist for on this night of July the 19th, 1952. Harry Barnes, poor man, had to try and sort it out himself. Ruppelt was in the Pentagon, but sound asleep. The astonishing comic thing is, if he had woken up and put his head out the window, he might have seen them. He might have seen them himself.
Right. Did that incident then bring about a reappraisal of the way the defense system worked around Washington?
No, it did not. It did not.
Dear.
The Air Force didn't do anything. On this night, about this occasion, there was absolutely nothing. Al Chopp, the Air Force press officer, couldn't get a single damn thing out of the Pentagon. And neither could Dewey Furney, another press officer, Air Force officer, could get no knowledge from, could get no information from any kind of intelligence contact. They were shut up in steel and concrete, and they wouldn't say a damn thing. Which is the worst thing that could have happened, really. Because, of course, in the face of the Pentagon silence, rumors and conspiracy theories started to be fertile, to say the least.
Mm. Yes, on the other hand, I suppose trying to keep quiet about it and saying nothing meant they couldn't get themselves into further deep water by admitting that they had no defense against these objects.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's remember one thing, which is frequently forgotten. The Pentagon, the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy are taxpaying funded. You know, they're funded by public taxes. They're obliged to make statements, unless it's a top secret, what's it or ever. They're obliged. They serve their public servants. They seem to consider themselves separate as from public service these days. You know, they are funded by taxpayers' money, and they're obliged to give the taxpayers information.
But they don't.
But they don't. No. I mean, it's a catastrophe. I mean, I'm not putting Britain against America, but if this happens here, you'd have questions in Parliament, you know, over a 48-hour basis, and somebody would have to pay the bill.
Yeah. Colin, you mentioned Roswell, which is obviously well known, I would think, by most people interested in UFOs. But as a result of Blue Book, Were there any other notable sightings or bits of evidence to prove the existence?
All the time. There were civilian organizations, like NICAP, NICAP. I don't think MUFON was formed in those days, but two or three others were acting on their own, by themselves, independent of the Pentagon. It was no good at all, and they got no cooperation from the Pentagon. Ruppelt or no Ruppelt.
Did the subject of UFOs after that period of time then move to what I would have thought would be an obvious question? What about the intelligence behind them? Did they not try to get some evidence about who they were or where they came from?
The civilians did. Yeah. Civilian writers from this time onwards, such as Bruce Maccabee, Stanton Friedman, and quite a few others, they attempted to get information. They wrote books of all kinds, speculating, and so did quite a few other people, including myself. I wrote a book on George Adamski, and I'm the proud author of a prize-winning biography of Charles Fort, and I wrote about them, but nobody official. We're independent authors. Nobody official wrote about them after Blue Book.
No.
Blue Book, after Ruppelt left, was put in the hands of journeymen, part-time journeymen, who shut up the files and put them in a warehouse and didn't bother any enterprising interpretation of the information. Finally, the Air Force got rid of the UFO in 1969 in the Condon Report. I'll spell that in case there's any embarrassing mistake. C-O-N-D-O-N, Dr. Condon, report of 1968. And he was a very leftish and waspish rationalist who trashed the UFO left, right and centre. And the Air Force, if you were to write to the Air Force these days, saying, or asking, what UFO investigations are you pursuing? The Air Force would write back with a standard letter saying we don't carry out any Air Force UFO investigations. And since 1969, when Dr. Condon committee said that they were all fantasies.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what you'll get. Yeah.
Right.
If you look at what we're talking about now, 52, we're over 50 years later.
Right.
There's been 50 years of those letters arriving on people's doorsteps as a reply from the Pentagon. People keep them as souvenirs.
Oh, yeah. Now, didn't they also conclude, or shall we say, put this reason forward to explain why they seem to have no further interest in UFOs?
No.
They believed they presented no danger.
That's a very, very nice assumption. No, they didn't say that, because if they did say that, that it would imply that, yes, they do exist, but we're taking no notice of them because they're doing no harm.
Yes.
And the logic of that would be they wouldn't like the logic of that at all. It would be a kind of tacit, implicit, silent agreement that they exist.
Right.
Which the Air Force doesn't want at all. I think this is the classic case of the wrong organization and the wrong problem. An Air Force, like the Army and the Navy, they're soldiers of a kind meant to... Just excuse me a moment. What,
yes.
Don't please. No. Meant to defend the nation. And they're not intellectuals. They're not people who are interested in esoteric matters. Or mystical matters, or obscure matters. They're soldiers of a kind, or policemen, and they don't have the tendency to get into matters of rather desperate intellectual complexity. Therefore, they just ignore it. Carry on. The UFOs are not shooting down F-16s, are they? No. They're not shooting down missiles, are they? No. So, we don't know what's happening, but they're not interfering with us, and so that's it. Get on with your own investigation.
Obviously, in the early days, the defence craft that were sent after the UFOs were sometimes ordered to shoot them down.
Yeah. Yeah, there were one or two cases like that. Yeah, indeed, they were ordered to shoot them down in the early days, but that order was rescinded. You see, the problem is, if you give an order to shoot down UFOs, you don't know what material a UFO is built of. Mm. It could be exotic material. Now, this leads us back to Harry Barnes summoning the F-94s. The F-94s came to investigate on July the 19th. They were armed warplanes with no knowledge of the tactical situation. If they'd opened fire on a UFO, no, there's no telling what might have happened. But nobody's thinking about this. Nobody's aware of this. Scientists in the Pentagon, they were not aware of it. Of the danger of an F-94 opening fire on an object which may be built of extremely exotic material, which would produce a nuclear explosion over Washington. Nobody knew about it. Nobody cared. If that F-94 pilot had seen one and had been ordered to open fire, then you might have had a nucleonic explosion over Washington and incinerated the nation's capital. But nobody's thinking about that. Imagine that. You know, I mean, kind of,
right.
Nobody's thinking about it. That's the comic thing to me, is that nobody's thinking about such a thing. And the whole affair.
I did hear a story quite recently that one of the reasons why they rescinded the order to shoot the UFOs down was because they realized that they had the ability to take away all the electrical functions on board our craft, and obviously that would have meant the end of the aircraft and possibly the death of the pilot. So I think they had a very hard think about that. Have you heard that? Would you agree?
Well, you're in the realm of unverifiable folklore here. Mm. I mean, there's a very good book published recently, I forget who wrote it, people are listening will know, about how UFOs switched off a missile system, an American intercontinental ballistic missile system, and switched off the firing mechanism. Well, here,
yes,
you are in the land of ufological folklore. I don't know whether this is true or not, but it's gone into the realms of folklore. As you know, with ufology, it's very, very difficult to say, oh, this guy's right, that guy's wrong.
Mm.
Yeah, we don't have material evidence for that, much of it anyway. And so the damn things are there, independent of scientific investigations, largely. We have no physical evidence of UFOs. But you can bet your bottom dollar, someone tomorrow will write to a newspaper and say they'd seen an Adansky-type UFO in a field when they were walking with their son and daughter. You can bet your bottom dollar that's going to happen. And the incident will go into folklore. That's all we've got, folklore.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was simply going to say that the bell-shaped craft that Adamski saw were around that period of time actually seen on quite a few occasions. So you could surmise from that Adamski did have an accurate sighting.
Well, Adamski, I just mentioned the word folklore. Well, Adamski's entered that realm. I mean, he really has. I wrote a book about Adamski, which is very well received. It's called Looking for Orthon. Orthon was the name Adamski's publisher gave to the being Adamski claimed he saw in the desert.
Right, yes.
The folklore, you could call it folklore, but it's a great postmodern act of theatre, which is unprecedented. People remember him. People bought my book. and still wonder about Adamski's desert contact. There's nothing more fascinating than ufology, even though it contains basketfuls of complete nutcases. Hello?
Right. Yes, I was simply thinking that where Adamski was, assuming he did have the sighting, the object was near enough to him to have seen the detail of it. And I think another person who saw that craft before Adamski was, if I got the name right, Colin Fry.
Yeah, Arnold Fry, yeah, well, I hope you've got another 5 hours to discuss Fry. You have another 5 hours to the program.
Right.
The strange thing is to me, in one of the Washington photographs of the orbs, one of the orbs looks like the Adamski scout ship. Now, this was in 52. Now, Adamski's book, The Flying Saucers Have Landed, which I dealt with in my book.
Yes.
That was in 53. That came out in 53. And his bell-shaped UFO, which he took a photograph, looked like the one in 52 above Washington. If you go for one of the photographs, you'll see it there. And I can't explain that. Unless, of course, Adamski, of course, is a man who's accused of great sin.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, you might not believe this. This is not by design, but just by coincidence. I've got a copy of Flying Saucers Have Landed in my hand at the moment because I had it on my desk.
Yeah,
and
oh, wow.
On the inside cover of his book, there is a close-up photograph of the bell-shaped craft, which he referred to as being Venusian, and that was photographed in December 1952 Palomar Gardens, California.
Yes.
By George himself.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, as I say, I have no definite answer to questions about this. I would say that ufology contributes mightily to modern mystical experience. You know, it's like old-fashioned fairies and gnomes. It's replaced fairies and gnomes and stories of Hans Hansen. And yet it's half in. My opinion as the biographer of Charles Fort is that the UFO does not completely fit. I don't want to get too philosophically complicated here. The UFO does not completely fit the Cartesian world picture. It's half in, half out of the frame. You see, human cultures see things through silver screen frames. We in the West, scientifically advanced, technologically au fait West, see mainly events, experiences within the Cartesian stroke Newtonian frame. We separate fact and fiction within this frame far, far too easily. We'll have to get used to intermediate forms of information, life, and spirit, which partake of one another. The web, for example, has made a tremendous contribution in this area. Fact, F-A-C-T, doesn't exist on the web. It's media. Now, we're into pretty complicated areas here. But no matter how complicated, they do shed light on the appreciation of mysteries between fact and fiction. Media cannot be measured in Cartesian forms. It exists as performances and images between fact and fiction. Someone like Stanton Friedman, for example, wouldn't accept what I'm saying at all. He's a rather old-fashioned scientist, hammer and anvil scientist. He's hardly got, I would say this, God bless him, I love Stanton Friedman, but I would say this, is people like Stanton Friedman haven't yet got to an age of information.
Yeah, well, I've I've interviewed him on my program, and I obviously knew of him before that. I've read his books and articles. He's very, very well informed indeed. But if you look back at history at various stages, there does seem to be some firm evidence from and even in ancient writings that people were visited by craft and intelligent beings even in those days, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yes, thousands of years ago, yeah. Well, I must admit at this point that I've seen one myself. I wrote about this in Nick Redfern's recent book on Men in Black.
Right.
Nick Redfern very kindly invited me to contribute to his book, Men in Black. And I wrote about an incident and an experience I'd had many years ago, and I saw a UFO, and I lost some time.
Right, will you tell us about that? Can you tell us about that one?
Do you want me to talk about that?
Well, tell us what you saw and what your impression was.
Yeah. Well, it was sometime in the 70s. It had been a very strange day. I had a flat in Notting Hill. I'm not moving very far. I'm still in Notting Hill. It had a strange atmosphere. I was writing plays at the time. And I had a play on at the Bush Theatre. And it was a Sunday night, and I went to the Bush Theatre. And suddenly the Bush Theatre was closed. I couldn't realize. it's so strange, because there was no theatre on Sunday night. So there I was, feeling like an idiot. I then got back to Notting Hill from Shepherd's Bush, and I walked past the Gate Cinema, and I saw a soft porn film being shown at the Gate Cinema. I have to tell you these sordid details because they're background, yeah?
Yes.
And I went in to see the soft porn film. It was called Salon Kitty. I laughed to myself when I got inside the cinema, because I thought, am I getting to the age where I go into soft porn cinemas and with a raincoat across my knees by myself? Right? I saw this film, and it was about 11 o'clock. I came out, got some cat food at the local supermarket, and got home, and it was by the railings of my girlfriend's basement flat when there was a huge light in the sky. Mm. It was the kind of light that if it had been a searchlight, it would have blinded me. But no, it had an ambient quality. And I looked at it and stared into it, fascinated. That was slightly to my right above in the night sky. I then turned to the left. And I will never forget this ever in my life. I saw a Lancaster bomber suspended quite still in the night sky, all in black with no lights. The dimensions were as if a Lancaster bomber was poised in the sky above me. The Lancaster, of course, there's only one flying. There was only one flying. It was like World War II bomber, famous British bomber. And there was no insignia on the bomber. It was blacked out. There were no lights. Its engines were not turning. It was just like a Hollywood production. Then I called to my girlfriend in the flat below. She came up the basement stairs. And I said to myself, if she doesn't see what I'm seeing, then I'll have to see a doctor. Seriously.
Yes.
And she said, as she reached the top of the steps, I saw that she had seen the Lancaster. In front of both of us, the Lancaster then morphed into a triangular craft and zoomed off north. And that was the end of it. Except we both looked up and saw yet another light racing across the sky, and a smaller light, came out of this light and executed the first four or five cycles of a sine wave. S-I-N-E, yeah? Everybody yeah. knows what a sine wave is. And then disappeared. I got back to the flat, quite silent. Am I loud and clear? Am I loud and clear? Am I loud and clear?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes, we're here, safe and sound. So, I've never heard of a sighting like that. That is most unusual indeed.
Yeah, there's an end bit to it.
I got right. down oh, yes.
to my girlfriend's flat, and there on the settee was a man in black.
Oh,
now,
well.
This is Notting Hill in the 1970s. I said to her, who is this? She introduced me, I forget his name. He was quite a nice man, well-spoken, with bronze golden hair.
Yes.
And he said, excuse me, I'm just staying for a moment to, because Alan, my friend in the top floor, is about to arrive, and he's not in at the moment. I can't remember what the conversation was, but he left very soon.
Well, wow.
And I came out in the basement yard, and he wasn't there. I've never had it. I don't usually go on radio and tell you ridiculous stories like this. Believe me, I'm not a fantasist. This happened to me and my girlfriend.
That's astonishing. Colin, I'm going to have to bring the program to a conclusion here. It's been terrific talking to you. You certainly
oh,
have
well,
a good
very
tale
nice of you to, say
to
that.
Tell.
It's been terrific talking to you.
Yes. Tell our listeners, where's your book available at the moment?
Amazon. And it's called
Amazon.
Flying Saucers Over the White House. Very good book, very good.
Right, that's fine. I think I'm correct in saying you haven't got a personal website at the moment.
Well, I have, yeah.
It's
called The Combat Diaries. Combat-Diaries, Colin Bennett.
Colin, right, repeat it again. Colin?
Excuse me. World Wide Web dot.
Yes.
Combat, C-O-M-B-A-T.
Yes.
Hyphen.
Yes.
Diaries.
What's the last word?
D-I-A-R-I-E-S Diaries. Combat hyphen Diaries.
I got it.
Diaries.
I got it. Okay.
.co.uk.
.co.uk. Okay, fine. I think everybody's got that one by now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Colin.
Thank you.
Great talking with you.
Well, say good night to you, sir.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, friend. Cheerio, Colin. Bye. Well, that was very interesting. I've got a minute or two just to quickly tell you that my guest next week will be Andy Tomlinson. He's a psychotherapist, lecturer, author, and we are going to discuss his latest book, Transforming the Eternal Soul. So thank you for being with me today. I'm sure you must have enjoyed that. I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.